Welcome back to Books with Bert. Let's continue with my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. Today, I want to tell the story of my favorite entrepreneur. This entrepreneur was called the most hated man in America. Yet the New York Times described him as the world's greatest giver. He was America's first billionaire, and he gave half of it away. Yet he was attacked as the biggest robber baron of the Gilded Age by opponents who were jealous of his success. At the same time, he was probably more responsible than any other single individual for the creation of the American middle class and the development of America as the world's greatest industrial power. Who is he? I am talking about John D. Rockefeller, and his story is uniquely American. Born in upstate New York in 1839, he did not have an easy childhood. His father was a part-time salesman and a full-time philanderer. Rockefeller's mother assured John that even though his biological father was undependable, God was the father who would never let him down. Rockefeller absorbed that message. It guided his life. As a strong Christian, he put into practice the biblical law, "Give, and it shall be given unto you." From his teenage years to his dying day, Rockefeller always gave a large portion of his income to charity. Rockefeller's special gift to the world was kerosene, cheap enough that anyone could buy it. Before the formation of his great company, Standard Oil, people lit their homes with candles or whale oil and heated them with coal or wood. But the candles were dim, the whale oil was expensive, and the coal was dirty. Rockefeller's affordable kerosene, processed from crude oil, made the world brighter, warmer, cleaner, and better for everyone. "We must ever remember," Rockefeller wrote to one of his partners in 1885, "we are refining oil for the poor man, and he must have it cheap and good." Rockefeller loved the business of business. He attended to every detail, always with the same goal, saving the customer money. That he made so much of it himself was a byproduct. He was also scrupulously honest. His first partner, Maurice Clark, said, "If there was a cent due a customer, Rockefeller wanted the customer to have it." Rockefeller displayed genius at getting creative ideas from his employees at Standard Oil. He paid them well and rarely had labor problems. He generously rewarded his chemists and engineers when they found new ways to get more kerosene out of a barrel of oil. Other oil refiners took the kerosene out of the crude oil and dumped the byproducts into nearby rivers. But the fires and pollution to the land and water repelled Rockefeller, who was perhaps the greatest environmentalist of his age. Not only was he a great lover of nature, he was the ultimate recycler. He believed there was a God-given use for every drop in a barrel of oil, and he was determined to find it. After the kerosene had been removed, Rockefeller's chemists found uses for the remaining components. The gasoline as fuel, some of the tars for paving, and other byproducts to manufacture paint, varnish, and even anesthetics. It's hard to imagine that the automobile industry would even have come into existence without the availability of Rockefeller's cheap oil. When Henry Ford was ready with his Model T, Rockefeller was ready to supply the gasoline. Some historians are jealous of Rockefeller's success. They say he got rich from special rebates from the railroads that transported his oil. But Rockefeller got large rebates because he was the largest shipper of oil in the country. Other critics, like writer Ida Tarbell, resented Rockefeller because her father was in the oil business, but had to get out because customers preferred Rockefeller's cheaper, high-quality oil to the oil sold by her father. By the early decades of the 1900s, millions of Americans had jobs in oil-related industries. Those jobs helped to build the American middle class. As Rockefeller said, "We saw the vast possibilities of the oil industry, stood at the center of it, and brought our knowledge and imagination and business experience to bear in a dozen, in 20, in 30 directions." Just because Rockefeller reached the top doesn't mean it was easy for him or for any entrepreneur to stay on top. During the 1880s, for example, many oil experts predicted Rockefeller's decline. Why? Because the whole industry was in jeopardy. The Pennsylvania oil fields were running dry, and electricity was beginning to compete with lamps for lighting homes. No one knew about the oil fields in Texas, and few suspected that the gasoline engine would be made the power source of the future. Meanwhile, Russia, yes, the Russians, had begun drilling and selling their abundant oil, and they raced to capture Standard Oil's foreign markets. Some experts predicted the imminent death of the American oil industry. Even Standard Oil's loyal officers began selling some of their stock. Rockefeller's solution to these problems was to stake the future of his company on new oil discoveries near Lima, Ohio. Drillers found oil in this Ohio-Indiana region in 1885, but they could not market it. It had a sulfur base and stank like rotten eggs. Even touching this oil meant a long, soapy bath, or social ostracism. No one wanted to sell or buy it, and no city even wanted it shipped there. Only Rockefeller seemed interested in it. According to Joseph Seep, who is the chief oil buyer for Standard Oil, and I quote, "Mr. Rockefeller went on buying leases in the Lima field in spite of the coolness of the rest of the board of directors of Standard Oil. Until Rockefeller had accumulated more than 40 million barrels of that high sulfur oil in tanks. He must have invested millions of dollars in buying and storing and holding the sour oil for 2 years, when everyone else thought it was no good." Rockefeller, however, had a plan. He hired two chemists to figure out how to purify the oil. He counted on them to make it usable. Rockefeller's partners were skeptical, however, and sought to stanch the flood of money invested in tanks, pipelines, and land in the Lima area. They held up their hands in holy horror at Rockefeller's gamble and even outvoted him at a meeting of Standard's board of directors. "Very well, gentlemen," said Rockefeller to his board of directors. "At my own personal risk, I will put up the money to care for this product. $2 million, $3 million if necessary." Rockefeller later described what happened. He said, "This ended the discussion, and we carried the board with us and continued to use the funds of the company in what was regarded as a very hazardous investment of money. But we persevered, and two or three of our very practical men stood firmly with me and constantly occupied themselves with the chemists until at last, after millions of dollars had been expended in tanking and buying the oil and constructing the pipelines and the tank cars to draw it away to markets where we could sell it for fuel, one of our German chemists cried, 'Eureka! We at last found ourselves able to clarify the oil.' That worthless Lima oil that Rockefeller had stockpiled suddenly became valuable. Standard Oil would be able to supply cheap kerosene for years to come." Rockefeller's exploit had come none too soon. The Russians had struck oil at Baku, 4 square miles of the deepest and richest oil land in the world. They hired European experts to help Russia conquer the oil markets of the world. In 1882, The year before the Baku oil was first exported, America refined 85% of the world's oil. 6 years later, this had dropped to 53%. Since most of Standard Oil was exported, and since Standard accounted for the overwhelming majority of America's exported oil, the Baku threat had to be met. At first glance, Standard Oil seemed certain to lose. First, the Russian oil at Baku was centralized in one small area. This made it economical to drill, refine, and ship from a single location. One independent expert estimated that Russia's costs of oil exporting were only one-third to one-half those of the United States. What's worse, Russia and other countries slapped high protective tariffs on American oil. This allowed inefficient foreign drillers to compete with Standard Oil. The Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, imported over 500,000 barrels of oil from Standard Oil in 1882, but they bought none by 1890. Rockefeller pulled out all stops to meet the Russian challenge. No small refinery would have had a chance. Even a large company like Standard Oil was at a great disadvantage. Rockefeller never lost his vision, though, of conquering the oil markets of the world. First, he relied again on his research team to help out. William Burton, who had helped to clarify the Lima oil, helped invent cracking, a method of heating oil to higher temperatures to get more use out of the product of each barrel. Engineers at Standard Oil helped by perfecting large steamship tankers, which cut down on the costs of shipping oil overseas. Second, Rockefeller made Standard Oil even more efficient. He used less iron in making barrel hoops and less solder in sealing oil cans. In a classic move, he used the waste from coal heaps to fuel his refineries. Even the sweepings from his factories he sorted through for tin shavings and solder drops. Third, Rockefeller studied the foreign markets and learned how to beat the Russians in their part of the world. He sent Standard agents into dozens of countries to figure out how to sell oil up the Huang Ho River in China, along the North Road in India, to the east coast of Sumatra, and to the huts of tribal chieftains in Malaya. Rockefeller's focus on quality meant that, in an evenly balanced price war with Russia, Standard Oil would win. The Russian-American oil war was hotly contested for almost 30 years after 1885. In most markets, Standard's known reliability would prevail if it could just get its price close to that of the Russians. Rockefeller and his partners always knew that their victory was a narrow triumph of efficiency over superior natural advantages. If, as John Archibald said in 1899, Archibald was an executive at Standard Oil, if there had been as prompt and energetic an action on the part of the Russian oil industry as was taken by the Standard Oil Company, the Russians would have dominated many of the world's markets. At one level, Standard's ability to sell oil at close to a nickel a gallon meant that hundreds of thousands of jobs for Americans in general, and Standard Oil in particular, were there. Rockefeller's margin of victory in this competition was always narrow. Even a rise of 1 cent a gallon would have cost Rockefeller much of his foreign market. A rise of 3 cents a gallon would have cost Rockefeller his American markets as well. In Standard Oil, Rockefeller arguably built the most successful business in American history. In running it, he showed the precision of a bookkeeper and the imagination of an entrepreneur. Yet in day-to-day operations, he led quietly and inspired loyalty by example. At board meetings, he would sit and patiently listen to all arguments. Until the end, he would often say nothing. But his fellow directors all testified to his genius for sorting out the relevant details and pushing the right decision even when it was shockingly bold and unpopular. "You ask me, what makes Rockefeller the unquestioned leader in our group?" said John Archibald, later a president at Standard Oil. "Well, it is simple. In business, we all try to look ahead as far as possible. Some of us think we are pretty able. But Rockefeller always sees a little further ahead than any of us, and then he sees around the corner. Rockefeller may have been the greatest entrepreneur in American history, but he was an oddity. The first billionaire in U.S. history, but no one could outgive him. From the time of his first job earning only 50 cents a day, the 16-year-old Rockefeller gave to his local Baptist church, to missions in New York City, and to the poor, black or white. He believed in the biblical admonition that not money, but the love of money, was the root of all evil. And Rockefeller always loved God much more than his money. He supported churches and missionaries all over the world. He lavishly endowed Christian colleges. He gave millions to medical research. Rockefeller was a giver because Jesus was a giver. Rockefeller liked to say that the greatest decision he made in his life was to make Jesus his Savior, and his second greatest decision was when he made Laura Spelman his wife. Rockefeller respected women and African Americans because that was the Bible message. According to the Bible, in Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ. Therefore, Rockefeller gave generously to black colleges, but was sad that so few black women attended college. Then he started a college for black women in Atlanta and named it Spelman College in honor of his wife. Rockefeller's biblical support for blacks and women put him at odds with many of the labor unions in America who excluded both. Samuel Gompers, head of the American Federation of Labor, said, quote, "The Caucasians are not going to let their standard of living be destroyed by Negroes, Chinamen, Japs, or any others," end quote. But since Rockefeller, not Gompers, was the one who was the successful entrepreneur, Rockefeller could give his money where he wanted it to go. Before Rockefeller died, in his 98th year, he had given away about $550 million, which was more than any other American before him had ever possessed. He had changed the world with his life. If you want to learn more about this great American, my favorite book on Rockefeller was written by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Nevins. It is a 2-volume history of Rockefeller entitled A Study in Power. Nevins interviewed many people who knew Rockefeller and studies his life carefully. His book, A Study in Power, is excellent and I recommend it. And that concludes today's episode of Books with Bert. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe and rate my podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or any other place where you can get podcasts so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you like today's episode and you want to find more content to fill your heart with love for America and for conservative ideas, be sure to check out YAF.org. The conservative movement starts here. Until next time, keep reading.